Good morning. I'd first like to thank Chuck and David for inviting me to help convene this session and for the opportunity to present some of the work that we've been working on over the last couple of years, first with the O layer, litter, and now more recently soil organic carbon using strategic level inventory information from the National Forest Inventory. So I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Charles Perry, Brian Walters, Luke Knave, Chris Woodall, and Chris Swanson. Four of the five of those folks are Forest Service cooperators, collaborators, and Luke Knave works at the University of Michigan. So I'd like to acknowledge those folks. So science talks, we often see curves like this. And this is really to remind myself, first of all, I work in a group that compiles the estimates of greenhouse gas emissions and removals for the forest land category for United Nations reporting. And, some of us might be familiar with this as the Keeling curve, but I look at this, and this is like the number of emails and phone calls I've gotten leading up to the Paris COP around carbon and forest contribution to the global carbon cycle. So this is really to provide some context around why we got into this this soil estimation work to begin with. So in 92, United Nations Framework Convention was more or less established, came into force in 1994, and ever since then, on an annual basis, the Conference of the Parties meet and have established expectations for countries to essentially halt this increase in atmospheric CO2. And forests in the United States play a really important role in mitigating the effects of emissions in our country. And so annually, forests across the land sector account for about 86% of all sequestration, and that translates into about a 13% offset, or it offsets about 13% of our total CO2 emissions each year. So forests play a really important role in our emissions, our carbon budget in the United States. And so soil carbon is a part of that. And we were interested in evaluating soil carbon and really updating methods and leveraging this huge investment that the National Forest Inventory has made in collecting soils information. And so that's really the thrust for this work. And so all of these results are published each year in April in this national report that's then submitted to the United Nations. So the Forest Service compiles the numbers, sends them to the Environmental Protection Agency, who then sends them to the State Department, and ultimately they end up with the United Nations. And we then distill that information in a variety of different products and projects and use that with a variety of other partners and to meet other obligations, whether they be national or international reporting instruments or just research projects. And so this is all to sort of say that, we've made some recent commitments, and those commitments, forests play a really large role in those. And so a few years ago in 2009, the Copenhagen Accords, the United States committed to reducing emissions by 17% from 2005 levels by 2020. And just last year, right around this time in Paris, we agreed to reduce those emissions by 26 to 28% below 2005 levels. And so really this is all just to say that we're trying to, in the Forest Service, do the very best we can to estimate stocks, but also stock changes. And we're always looking for ways to make improvements in our estimates so that we can accurately reflect the contribution of forests to these emissions reduction targets. And so in the group that I work in, we sort of have a set of improvement paradigms, and really those are driven in large part by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is really the governing body that sort of assigns or establishes a set of guidelines by which we have to follow in this international reporting. And to that end, one of the main thrusts is that we expand the use of in-situ data. So wherever we can, we want to use information from the NFI. Integrate auxiliary information. So can we grow our feature space? Feature space is something that's constantly in my mind now because we're trying to grow this sort of 3D, this sort of three-dimensional feature space and leverage auxiliary information in any way that we can and integrate auxiliary information in any way that we can. we have a responsibility to align our national and international reporting instruments. So making sure that our national and state level reports are consistent with the national and international reports, etc. We try to maintain transparency and open access. So just like Dave, wherever we can, we make this, all the FIA data is publicly available. And really part of this talk is a plug for FIA and to go out and use the data. It's all publicly available 6 months after the data is collected. It's online and it's free to anyone that's interested. Incorporate emerging science. So our group, while we have the responsibility to report to the United Nations, we are also actively engaged in research within the Forest Service, but also working with partners from across universities, nonprofits, other government agencies, etc. And we're a small group, so we're constantly looking for partners. So if anyone sees anything here that excites them or if they've got problems with things, I see you as a partner, and I would love to talk to you after. And finally, we need to remain nimble to address ever-changing requests, guidance, and stakeholder needs. So now to the soils part of the talk. So importance of carbon in soils. I don't really need to tell this audience why soil carbon is important. You know, it's the largest terrestrial carbon sink. It's really important from a reporting perspective. A lot of that carbon across ecosystems is found in forests. And this soil carbon, you know, is an overall sort of metric for soil health, but it really influences biological, chemical, and physical soil functions. And there's a lot of uncertainty. So I'm not a soil scientist. I'm really a biometrician. And so I had a really steep learning curve, and I'm still learning. So forgive me if I make mistakes. Dave and Chuck and others can help me along the way here. But anyway, why did we change SOC methods in our greenhouse gas reporting and in the National Forest Inventory? Well, just to give you a little history, so historically we've used CIRGO and STATSCO information from the Natural Resources Conservation Service. And with that information, we developed a rather simple model using forest type group as the primary variable to estimate soil carbon. And then that estimate was sort of static across stand age. So it was really stand age and forest type were the major drivers in this model. And this map is really here to show you or to describe, to illustrate the fact that the majority of the NRCS pedons, and some of those are actually just expert observations, fall outside of forests. So the gray there in the lake states, this is a picture of Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, the gray represents forest land. The red dots represent NFI plots with soil measurements. And the blue dots represent pedons from NRCS that have historically been used to predict soil carbon to a depth of a meter in the NFI. And so the fact that we were relying on these pedons that were predominantly found outside of forests was a little bit fishy to me, anyway. And so we just wanted to test this. Now that we have more than a decade worth of soil measurements from the NFI, we wanted to evaluate those models. But as you'll see here, it was a bit of a challenge. So why change soil methods? This is sort of a continuation. Because we have this extensive inventory now of soil observations across the United States, on the order of 5,000 observations, consistently collected on these plots where we collect a whole suite of other site and tree level attributes. And so here's just sort of a distribution. I know this is a really long tale. I could have truncated this for the talk, but this is just sort of a distribution of the SOC estimates across the four regions. So pretty consistent trend. And now we'll just describe to you the NFI sampling frame and just how we go about measuring and sampling soils in NFI. So we've got sort of three phases to the National Forest Inventory. There's the pre-field phase, which is essentially a remote sensing exercise where we identify forest and non-forest. And because we're the forest inventory, we only visit plots that meet our definition of forest land. And so those plots that meet our definition of forest land, there's plots across all lands, but only the core field plots that meet our definition are visited. And each core area represents 2,400 hectares. And then every 16th core plot is an intensive field plot or an intensive field area. And these intensive plots have information on soils and litter and down dead wood and lichens and a whole suite of other site and tree level attributes. And it's really these intensive field plots that are the focus of this study. And so here's sort of a zoomed in picture of this sort of tessellated grid of basically a zoomed in picture of our sample frame. It's this tessellation and it's panelized. So each color or pattern there is visited each year. And so in the eastern U.S., we measure plots every 5 to 7 years. In the west, we measure plots every 10 years. And here's an example of the plot design. And you'll see adjacent to those four numbered subplots are some transects. And those transects are the soil and litter sampling lines. And so they're off plot because these are destructive samples. And we'll get into some of this at the end in terms of remeasurement and whether we can consider them remeasurements or not. But this is just to illustrate sort of how we're arriving at this information. And so at each one of those sampling transects, we collect litter information, and we remove that, and we get bulk density, carbon content, and a whole suite of other information. We measure litter depth and other things. And then once that layer is removed, we take a soil core using a slide hammer. One soil core, but it's split into two samples, 0 to 10 centimeters and then 10 to 20 centimeters. And we collect a whole variety of other attributes in terms of coarse fragments, a whole variety of other attributes in the database. And so NFI sampling and reporting depth. So we measure to a depth of 20 centimeters. We've historically reported to a depth of 1 meter, and IPCC suggests that we report to a depth of 30 centimeters. So that's a lot to sort of take in. And so it required a fair amount of modeling, and not unlike the effort that Dave just described, we integrated a variety of information. So we used all of those FIA plots and samples. We harmonized that information with ISCN profiles that were consistent, or we believed to be consistent, with our definition of forest land. And that really grew our observations, both horizontally, but also vertically. So we were looking for plots or profiles that went beyond our 20-centimeter depth so that we could develop depth profiles. And we did this by, so this is a broad depth profile, but then we did this by soil order. And we looked at dozens and dozens of different linear and nonlinear models. I spent a lot of time being sort of a biometrician, looking at different models, and not being a soil scientist, I swam for a long time before I finally found where I was going. So anyway, we found this log-log model to be essentially the to best characterize these depth profiles. And here's just an example where we've log transformed the data, and this histogram here really shows the residuals. So the residuals are normally distributed around all the data. And we, of course, did this for every single model, and I looked at all sorts of different model validation techniques. We used cross validation, etc., on this phase just to get the depth information. And so once we had that depth information by soil order, we used that to develop these sort of depth profiles. And so this is just a broad illustration. I guess on your left, we've got the, for all soil orders combined, we've got sort of the prediction from 20 centimeters to a meter with a prediction interval. And I apologize, I didn't put the confidence interval on this particular graphic. But then on the right is just sort of an illustration of what the different soil order, the profiles look like for these other soil orders. And so how do we take these intensive observations and now these depth profiles that we've developed and expand that to all FIA plots? Because right now we report soil carbon on every forested FIA plot, and there's on the order of 127,000 of those. And so it really becomes a matrix, much like David described, where we looked at all of those different modeling techniques and then a series of different parametric, non-parametric machine learning algorithms. We didn't go into the Bayes world, but we've got a postdoc that's Bayesian, so we might go in that direction next. So we started with this. How do we get here? Well, the way that we did that, we tested a variety of parametric, non-parametric approaches, and we ultimately landed on random forests. So we used cross-validation and many of the same techniques. That it was nice that Dave went before me because I gloss over a lot of that. We looked at a variety of attributes. We tried to develop as broad and robust a feature space as we possibly could, leveraging all sorts of auxiliary information to really capture the soil-forming factors that we believed were sort of driving soil carbon stocks, or at least the development of soil carbon, but also influencing the dynamics. So things like time since disturbance, number of disturbances on those plots, maximum annual temperature, mean annual temperature, all sorts of climate variables linked to that exact plot location. Of course, it's downscaled climate data. We use PRISM information in this case. And also things like surficial geology and other things like that in this sort of broad feature space. And then we evaluated those different features in this in both a parametric, non-parametric sort of framework. And so we pruned this model quite a lot. I think we had on the order of 60 attributes or variables that we originally included in our model, and we worked to reduce that model down to the most meaningful attributes, and we landed, I think, on, what, 8 or 9 attributes. So the geographic location, the elevation, the vegetation type, some climate variables, soil order, and then surficial geology proved to be the most important. And so, again, we used a variety of techniques to evaluate these things, you know, some stepwise approaches, but then also just, you know, looking at, you know, correlations of individual attributes against the dependent variable here, and looking at some of the trends. Do these trends make sense? Is one attribute acting as a proxy for another, and how can we evaluate these things? So I would really say that this exercise was really kind of a combination of art and science, where we tried to bring in some really robust methodological approaches to evaluate and prune this model or these different models, but also we wanted to make sure that they biologically made sense, similar to what Pierre described in terms of looking at his two maps. And another thing that was really important to us, and forgive me, I didn't really include it in this talk, was this idea of uncertainty and separating the natural variability, separating the variability that we know is inherent in these soil samples from uncertainty. You know, they're related, but in the uncertainty piece, you know, there's all sorts of things that contribute to that. There's sampling uncertainty. There's measurement uncertainty. There's model selection uncertainty. There's model parameter uncertainty. There's all these things. And with soils, on top of that, you've got, with measurements, you've got, you know, lab analyses that are done at different locations, and there's all of it really just becomes a very complex thing. And so that's something that we continue to work on to try and find the other, as many sources of the uncertainty as we can, and integrate those into this modeling framework. Really, number one, so that we can adequately characterize total uncertainty in our estimates, but also so that we can start to identify what we can improve in our measurements, our sampling, our measurements, and our modeling. And so, you know, this is just one graphical way that we did a variety of different comparisons from our observations to our predictions here. So this is just graphically, it shows sort of the difference between, you know, our old model, the old model which relied basically on NRCS, Sirgo Statsco information, and our observations, and the new model. And again, much like what David described, we basically separated our data into a test and training data set, and we did that multiple times. We used 10-fold validation and did this multiple times to ensure that we weren't getting R-squareds on the order of 0.9 that were really should have been on the order of 0.2. And so this is the result. This is what we came up with as a sort of as a first-order map that we've developed using this, what we're calling this methodological framework or soil carbon modeling framework, and so it makes sense biologically in many cases, and we're really interested to evaluate this against some of like the rapid soil carbon assessment from NRCS and other products. Rodrigo Vargas is doing a lot of work there, and we're speaking with a lot of other folks doing similar work, which interestingly, you know, this is the first time I've seen Dave's talk. I gave a similar talk at AGU last year, and Rodrigo's student was doing something similar, and it's really remarkable how a lot of the methods being used independently sort of align. It's reassuring that maybe we're not completely off base in what we're doing. So the takeaways from this work, the contribution of soil carbon in forests has been grossly underestimated based on this analysis in recent national inventory reports and in the NFI in the United States. New predictions represent an estimated 40% increase in carbon stocks per unit area relative to previous estimates used in our UN reporting. And this SOC accounts for, well, it used to account based on the distribution of carbon stocks across all of the pools and forests. Soils accounted for about 40% of total carbon. And based on this new method, they account for around 70%. And looking at the literature, that's much more consistent with what other folks have found. And so we think that this method, I'm still calling it kind of a first-order improvement, represents an improvement, I think, over what we were using. It addresses or gets at some of the drivers, we believe, of soil formation and some of the drivers of change. But we recognize that there's a tremendous amount of spatial and temporal variability, and a lot of uncertainty remains. And to that end, I hope, you know, beyond my talk, we can discuss this idea of remeasurements. What is a remeasurement, given these are destructive samples and the enormous variability that exists? And then secondarily, is there a way that we can integrate, I've been reading a lot, again, not as a soil scientist, about soil microbes and how important they are in carbon cycling. And is there a way that we can start to integrate information or at least make approximations about soil microbes and other factors that might help us explain some more of that variability and reduce some of the uncertainty in our second order estimates. So with that, thanks. I'm not sure if I have any time for questions. Yeah. What's that? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so most of them, the depth profiles were, you know, you saw sort of a nice, you know, most of the carbon was distributed in the top 30, 40 centimeters. Histosols is pretty uniform. So that was reassuring to me that, you know, that the carbon was distributed more evenly across. But, so they were included. So we used a map basically to develop to find soil order, you know, or in our model anyway, and I think we used StatsGo, and in some places where StatsGo didn't exist, Surgo. So we had soil order in there, and I think we had on the order of like maybe 300 or 400. I think I had it in a table 300 or 400 histosols. Yeah, most of them in the Lake States. You know, for us, it was really a way to organize things. Again, remember that this is strategic level inventory. So we've got a plot basically every 38,000 hectares. So really broad scale. But that's a great suggestion and something we'll look at. Thank you.